I'm the doctor. These are my new best friends, Ryan, Graham and Yaz.
Hello there, welcome to episode 83 of the Target Files, where we're going to be discussing Demons of the Punjab. This is Alex in Exeter.
And this is Mike in Swansea, hello.
Written by Vinny Vatel and directed by Jamie Child. So Mike, what did you think of this absolutely excellent episode we had on last night? I know it's been getting interesting reviews and comments on Twitter and social media today.
That way, Al, you know, you've given your thoughts away already as well. An excellent episode, just utterly superb. I'll tell the listeners now, I'll give it a 10, let's pack up. No, just joking. Just discussing it in detail.
No, I was completely like that as well, because it's just, you know, episode from start to finish, it's just a perfect episode. Again, you know, maybe using the same sort of mindset as Rose, where you know you get a villain, but that isn't really the villain, and I think it works so well. Again,
I'm set within the partition of India into India and Pakistan, 1947, bookended by Yaz meeting up with her nan, looking a slightly made up old lady like one of the comedy characters in Goodness Gracious Me from time to time, but we soon got over that. And a lovely conversation around the family table. Interestingly enough, she told Yaz she was her favourite granddaughter, so that may explain some of the conflict we saw with Yaz's sister earlier on in the season.
Yeah, maybe that's the reason why, you know, everybody thinks Yaz is great in her family. That sort of might cause a bit of conflict, unfortunately. But yeah, there's just a very nice sort of thing at the beginning with, you know, her gran and having this watch and not knowing why the watch is sort of special, and then jumping straight into, like, you know, take it that probably wasn't India, it's more like, I think it was somewhere, going straight into this sort of episode and having lots of little backstory bits and things that have been happening to them while they've been on their sort of TARDIS, you know, sort of events with the rest of the TARDIS crew, basically.
I think it was a Spain shoot for this one, Al, so Spain look.
Yeah, those sort Asian of beautiful landscape bits at the beginning, you know, where, you know, they come out of the TARDIS and it's sort of meant to be, you know, it's going to be India, and it's obviously not. It's Spain looking as good as it seems to for these sort of things when BBC do things away, basically. And yeah, it just looks really stunning. And then, you know, you instantly meet these sort of two quite main characters, you know, on the road. And that sort of great thing about the TARDIS is sort of, you know, translation circuits. But, you know, your Punjabi's really good, and you sort of think, well, they're speaking English, so that's quite a fun bit there.
Yeah, you can get into over-explaining certain elements of the TARDIS with the translation circuits, can't you? But that's a good, humorous way to do it.
I think there's lots of bits of the, you know, what can come a bit nerdy with the TARDIS, what we explain really quickly, you know, like, you know, the whole telepathic circuits and the translation bits there were done really sort of quick and nifty, I think. They were done really well.
And I wanted to talk a little bit about the metaphor reminiscent of City of Death, of the cracked watch. That sort of bookends the episode as well in the conversations between Yaz and her nan.
Yeah, it's a really sort of clever idea that, you know, this watch is something really important. We find out later why it's important, and bookends it really nicely. You know, everybody wants the watch to be fixed, but, you know, her nan goes, no, it mustn't be fixed, because he knows why it's been cracked, you know, when she gives it to Yaz, really.
And a total metaphor for, no matter how much they want throughout the episode to fix this event, they have to leave it be.
You know, metaphor related to the watch as well, so that was some lovely bits about when, you know, the big reveal does happen, and, you know Ryan and Graham's characters know what's going to happen to this particular character, and there's just those lovely bits where, you know, Graham and that are in tears. And I think definitely this week, you know, Bradley Walsh really came into his own, I think.
Possibly got a bit more to do than Tosin Cole, but really the episode for me did belong to Mandip Gill. So much emotion. The whole idea of face acting, you know, close-ups on TV, you know, what you see behind the performer's eyes. She was absolutely fantastic in what she conveyed in this episode. She knew something very sad, or realised something very sad was going to occur as it went on. The whole series of doubt, you know, it had you watching the wedding scene at the end thinking, you know, something horrific has come in. And Mandip Gill really showed that sort of behind her eyes for me. It was a wonderful performance.
Oh, well, same here. I think, you know, that the sort of little details of her character, the whole episode was really very good. But I think, you know, that division where, you know, she should be really enjoying this, but it's, you know, can't really enjoy because she knows what's going to come, you know, when she's on the sort of balcony with Graham, and he's sort of saying, you know, you should be enjoying this, really, and she sort of can't, really. So I thought those were really good scenes as well.
And as you said, slowly unravelled, we have the demons brought in fairly early on their trip to the Partition Era. And it's a good sort of red herring to use them again, isn't it? To show that they could be the villains to begin with, but it's a good twist to show that they are reformed characters.
Yeah, that was a really sort of clever trick, and it wasn't done heavy-handedly. I thought, you know, you think these are, you know, assassins, and they're going to kill everybody, and then, you know, you think they've killed the priest on the road. When it, you know, there's a great twist at the end where you find out, no, they actually have reformed themselves, and they like to witness, you know, and try and be there for, you know, when people die. So it's sort of a really nice twist. And again, I think because it's dealing with such a big issue of, you know, of what happened between India and Pakistan at that time, but the villains and the monsters don't need to be that important. It's the actual people in the air that become the monsters, really. I think that was a really nice twist.
Yeah, possibly the only criticism I'm going to have about this whole episode, Al, is I found the Doctor at times early on a little bit jarring in her childlike sort of wonder of the situation. There was the odd bit of, I wouldn't say, I can't think of the word, dodgy humour, but she seemed a little too light in the situation. I suppose, in terms of the narrative, the story, it was before we realised the dark consequences as we went on. As I soon saw Jodie sort of react much better to the situation towards the end, when we knew this horrific event was coming.
Well, yeah, maybe a little bit. Well, I think there is a sort of gradual build-up with Jodie's thought, you know, when she sort of does try to tell, you know, Yasmin quite firmly not to say anything what, you know, could lead to things changing. So I think there's a gradual build-up. I think it's that balance what Jodie is getting there. I think there's that balance of trying not to be too sort of funny and humorous. I think the bit where she sort of goes off on tangents is slightly annoying sometimes. Well, I think her performance was really good by the end, because she knew what was coming with, you know, one of the characters, and that whole dealing with it, I think, is done very well throughout the episode, I think.
And I think possibly a bit of inconsistency with previous incarnations in terms of how little persuading, really, she needed to take Yaz back to this key event.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit there. But she does start, you know, you can say, you know, there's a little bit there where she goes, oh, I shouldn't be so kind. I should have, you know, I think there are little bits of regret. I know it's not as much, you know, as it was being Peter Capaldi. There would be no chance of going back to this historical event. Yasmin would have to probably do a lot of convincing to the Peter Capaldi doctor, or maybe the, you know, Bill Harp, you know, or Pat Troutman. So I think she's trying to be a bit more lighter, I think.
It did make me wonder on the whole mysticism of Doctor Who, though, whether the TARDIS does influence her in that respect, as we saw in the Doctor's Wife episode. Sir Anne Jones appearing as the embodiment of the TARDIS says, you know, I didn't always take you where you wanted to go, but I took you where you needed to go. And perhaps it's sort of the telepathic circuits getting into the Doctor's head, realising she needs to go and see this event, you know, she needs to go and show it to Yaz, whatever the purpose of it is.
Well, yeah, maybe. There's that whole sort of, you know, they're meant to be linked together, but we never know because it's not her own TARDIS. I think they're trying to make the Doctor more compliant, maybe, to her, you know, her friends or companions, whatever we're calling them. I think there's meant to be more of a connection, I think, with the, you know, with the companions, I think, this season.
Yes, and on to the supporting cast, Al. The brothers, Prem and Manish, two superb performances, I thought.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because I thought so as well. Well, there's been a lot of Facebook editing, there's a lot of complaining about, oh, were they reading a script out loud? It looked they were terrible. And I thought they were really good. There was that real diversion between, you know, one who wanted to be still complete Indian and one who wanted to live in this new world because of who he was marrying. And that sort of whole diversion between them was done really well, I thought.
Yes, I thought the gentleman playing Manish really conveyed that sort of blind loyalty, you see, in a lot of sort of what we'd call extremist groups nowadays. And there was a very interesting reference to his brother Prem saying, this is a young man who's listened to too many angry men on the radio. And that was sort of relevant to what we see going on in social media today.
I think there's a lot of references to, you know, how extremism sort of gets into some poor, innocent people these days, you know, through social media and sort of listening to stuff, you know, and not understanding the true impact of it. And I think that was grown greatly by, you know, the younger brother, you know, and he's trying to say, you know, you don't listen to me any longer, and he's sort of, well, no, because you're talking rubbish, basically. And there's that sort of whole impact by the end of the episode where, you know, the one thing you wouldn't expect does happen.
Yeah, I think crucially, Al, you've used the word so well there, impact. We see how these sort of situations of war and division impact on an everyday family, don't we? And the radio is just there in the background to guide us and show us what is happening. But, you know, we have the youngster Manish, you know, almost proud that he knows what is happening. You know, he knows that certain people are coming along to claim the land, and it's so horrific when it's pushed into that everyday family setting, isn't it?
Well, totally, because, you know, you just see this sort of a normal, from the beginning of the episode, you just see this as a normal sort of family sort of farm, and it's, you know it's in India, but you don't know what the date is, what the event is happening. And as soon as that event happens, you know, Manish is sort of very happy, sort of got fireworks, and they're all happy, and not taking into the consequence, sort of nearly a million people died, basically, in riots, and the impact of it, really.
Yeah, and this is just such a relatively small scale episode, isn't it? But, you know, it just shows that every consequence of war, you know, to every family is so tragic.
Totally, totally. And just, you know, one family here, will, you know, being split apart in many ways. You know, they've lost one of their brothers and their son, and the whole impact then is going to be even more, you know, taken apart when they're sort of told you have to live in Pakistan or you have to live in India. There's no choice, really.
And then, as you said, it allows us to have those beautiful scenes, like you've already mentioned. Bradley Walsh, you know, telling Prem, isn't it, that, you know, he's such an important man, even though he knows this young man is going to his death straight after his wedding.
From when, you know, the doctors told them what's going to happen, the sort of acting between Bradley Walsh goes up a gear, I think, and there's some beautiful bits where, you know, he's at the sort of stag party with Prem and in sort of trying to give him a voice, and, you know, and those last bits where there's tears and it's like, just so well done by Bradley Walsh, I thought.
Beautifully played. We do also have the lightness and darkness with the humour coming in of the doctor officiating the wedding.
Yeah, I thought that was a really good, that's so far, I thought one of the best sort of speeches we've had in the Jodie Whittaker era, I think. You know, it's sort of, it's very lightly done, but it was also a lot of darkness in it, because he knows that, you know, he's not going to survive. You know, he's going to be shot, basically. Sorry, spoiler there. But, you know, Prim's not going to survive the night, basically. So he's trying to make it as happy as possible, and that's sort of really well shown.
Yes, and that allowed the sort of lightness and the darkness we've seen from previous allocations. From previous incarnations to shine through in that scene.
Things came out really well in that scene, I think.
Yes, direction-wise, Al, I wanted to talk about, as we move towards the final scenes, the very tense standoff at the end that ends in tragedy. And it was, I think, so well directed again, Jamie Charles returning after the woman who fell to Earth, and I think he did the ghost monument as well?
Yeah, he did the first two. And sort of that last sort of scenes where, you know, you see those sort of marauders coming into the farm, and you know it's going to happen. I just, you know, sort of cut and beautifully shot, I thought.
And so tense when we see the finger on the trigger, and you're almost reminded again straight away it is Doctor Who, because the two sort of demons appear to say they're going to protect Prem now.
Yeah, most definitely. I think, you know, it's had that little bit of, you know, sort of adding fantasy to reality, sort of balance really well in this episode. And then you hear that, sort of, you don't actually see it, so it's not, you know, R-rated or anything, but, you know, you sort of hear that gunshot, and you know it's going to, you know, kill him, basically. I think was the one that, you know, really well done.
And Yaz seems totally frozen, and we see the Doctor grimace, don't we? Jodie plays that so well, that shot.
Oh, that shot is just horrific. It's horrific on a, you know, on a scale more than actually seeing the shot. You know, as, you know, the great thing, you know, in film is less is more, I sometimes think, and that sort of facial expression of Jodie and sort of Yaz's, you know, horrificness of it happening, you know, knowing what this is going to sort of change her grandmother forever, basically.
And the juxtaposition is we've got this wonderful weather in this wonderful countryside setting.
Yeah, it's just, it looks stunning, the way it's shot, and it's bright and beautiful, and then around it you've got all this horrificness happening, really. I think that sort of juxtaposition works so well.
And also utterly beautiful, I think, this week was Sega Nakanola's score.
Oh, it's absolutely stunning. I thought it was some, the last bit I thought was done by Talban Singh, but it was another really famous Indian composer, but it's actually him, and it was apparently beautifully all done at Abbey Road. And it's the music throughout the whole of this episode, right to the end, when you get that sort of Indian version of the Who theme, is stunning, I think.
I certainly think Sagan does like his sort of choral-esque harmonising in terms of the synthesizer work. Perhaps it hasn't been as well suited to certain episodes, but it certainly was well suited in this one, where you had that blend with sort of Asian voices as well.
Yeah, those sort of mixture of sort of, you know, a very sort of Asian voices and choral, and then sort of Indian drums to really sort of pick up the pace of the accent. I just think he got it spot on. I think, you know, he does, yeah, as we both know, he does like a synthesizer, and I expect in his studio he's got quite a few, I expect. And the sort of, he likes that sort of very ethereal, I think is the best way to describe it, in some. His music was so on the ball for this episode, right to those end credits where you had that Indian verse, I said, of the Doctor Who theme tune, was really, well thought out, and you can tell it's done beautifully at Abbey Road Studios. It's one of the best studios in London you can get.
Yeah, hugely sort of ethereal ending, really, wasn't it? You know, suitably different in tone to the song we had at the end of Rosa.
Yeah, I think it had the same sort of feeling, what was completely different. You had that sort of feeling that Aspen loves her grandmother, and that's, you know, they love each other back, and had that respect not to pry into, even though she knows now, not to pry into her past space. And I think the music just sort of, you know, comfified that really well.
And to end on a lighter note, some lovely humour put in by the actress playing Yaz's nan, talking about giving old letters to her husband, and she said, you know, don't read the naughty bits to her granddaughter.
Yeah, there was just some lovely bits, a lovely balance of lightness and dark throughout the whole of this episode, I think.
And the idea of Sheffield being a very exotic place as well.
Yeah, that great thing, you know, Sheffield's that lovely, excitable. It's a nice place, I wouldn't go as far as say it's, you know, exciting. So, my score, as we've already probably said, is going to be quite obvious. It's a 10 all over for this episode, because it just starts from start to finish having a good storyline. It has a lot of background to Yaz's family, and not on the annoying front this time. It sort of tells you a lot about, you know, why her grandmother moved to Sheffield many years back, and it sort of had a lot of depth, you know, to do with the conflict of racism and sort of the issues that are still happening in the 21st century. And I think those issues were really well done. Yes, it told you a bit of history, and hopefully people didn't know about that will go and look into it a bit more, and probably googled it afterwards and looked into it. And I thought the acting on all fronts was on a really high level. It wasn't like some people thought, where they thought people playing Maris and Patel were sort of reading scripts, or I thought they weren't. I thought they were really good. The music from Sagan is again fantastic and really added to it, so I think a 10 or over, really.
Yes, I'm not going to say much more, Al, because I scored it already, and if you just listen to what we've already said in the podcast, it's been generally a love letter to this total 10 out of 10.
Definitely, definitely, because it's just, I think it is definitely the best episode after Rosa. I think Rosa is there as my number two favourite at the moment, I think.
And, you know, tone-wise, the setting, actually broadcasting this on Remember It Sunday was a good decision, because I think the order of the episodes was changed around slightly late in the day. We may have been meant to have the Witchfinders episode, I think, was originally scheduled to go in this week. But it's a good reminder that so many people from India, from Pakistan, from that part of the world, from the rest of the world, fought with the Allies in both the wars.
Well, yeah, there's this great thing. I don't know if you've ever been to the Brighton Pavilion in Brighton. That was basically a hospital when the Second World War and the First World War for Indian soldiers, basically, who were made to come over and help. So, you know, it's sort of a really nice sort of, to the, you know, being Armistice Day yesterday and being a lot about the 100 years since the First World War. So I think it was a very good idea to move this one to that date, because I think it had a lot to say about war and conflict, I think.
Yes, and, you know, sadly, you know, set 2 years after the end of the Second World War, but there is always fallout wherever, in certain parts of the world, there is always fallout of war that continues for many years.
The way that these issues can be, you know, dealt with and sort of simple things like Doctor Who, and I think they did them well. I think, you know, over the, maybe it didn't have as much to do with, you know, the First World War or the Second World War, but it had a, you know, still had that feeling that people were just surviving after the Second War in India and Pakistan. It was A, meant to be a new sort of start, you know, with the two countries, but, you know, it led to more bloodshed and another war base physically for a good couple of years, and it still sort of trickles down the generation still to this day, I think. So I think, you know, these things are important to mention on Armistice Day and, you know, at any day, really.
Yes, it's almost going back to that Hartnell-esque historical, isn't it, where you can't really interfere, you have to observe things going on. A lot of people have referenced the massacre in relation to this one.
Yeah, I think that'd be true. That's a good one to look at. I'm not too sure if there's an actual DVD or TV, but you can do a great audiobook we've reviewed beforehand done by Peter Purvis. And yeah, I think there's a lot, you know, you have to really think about the consequences of what happens if you get involved. And I think, you know, don't, you have to have drama so all the characters always get involved. And, you know, in all good fantasy and, you know, like Star Trek, that's a prime directive sort of thing, and sort of always gets slightly effective somehow. And I think, you know, there's no way that if you're there and it's a member of your family, you wouldn't be able to get involved. So I think, you know, throughout things to discuss about the episode and other Doctor Who things is that last night's ratings, so a little bit low, were still pretty good. I were 5.7 on airing, and I expect when you add catch up and with laptops and phones, it'll probably go up to about the normal 7 to 8, which is always a really good thing, including the tabloids and people being moaning about how, you know, these figures are low and that, you know, people aren't watching it. But my advice is just look at the airtime figures and you'll see, well, it's actually been hanging quite nicely in the 8 million for every episode of this season so far, which is a great thing. Other things in the Doctor Who land is that there's rumours today that in Cardiff, using Cardiff Castle, there's going to be a new sort of Doctor Who experience. We're not exactly sure what it's going to be yet, but it's planned to be open by next summer, apparently. BigFinish.com have announced today that their Legends of Doctor Who box set, which is out next year for 20 years of Big Finish, is going to have a connection between Doctor Who, the fifth Doctor, and Jenny, which of course means that for the first time, Peter Davison will be working with his daughter, Georgia Moffat, otherwise known these days as Georgia Tennant. So I think what I've been watching while I'm here, to give you some ideas of good media content, I've been listening to the new Muse album, which is absolutely fantastic. If you like the rock group Muse, you'll love. Film-wise, I haven't really seen much, but I'm going to go and see Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them 2 on Friday. Hopefully at midnight, if I can get audio description at the Picture House with my brother. Old film wise, I did sit down and watch Talented Mr. Ripley, which is a great Matt Damon film, at the weekend because it was on my box and I thought there's nothing on, and I watched that. And I also need to sit down and watch the Peter Jackson special thing for World War One, was on BBC Two last night.
I saw it. It's absolutely brilliant, Al.
You have watched it. I didn't know. I haven't got around to watching it. I was doing stuff. It's on my agenda to watch.
I knew very little about it, apart from he'd colourised a lot of footage. But being the genius that Peter Jackson is, you know, apparently he got some lip readers in to try and decipher what the people were saying in the black and white footage. And he's managed to add sort of voices to it that way. And he's added a lot of background sounds. And there's just so much detail and effort gone into 90 great minutes that really, really puts you in the thoughts of the people who fought so bravely for good. Just such a wonderful piece of, I wouldn't say entertainment, just one of those important films that a lot of people do need to watch.
Most definitely. I saw it's on the top of the iPad. I'm going to watch it later. I was doing stuff after Doctor Who last night, so I didn't get around to watching it. But I will definitely watch it because it has been getting really good reviews on Twitter with other people. I'm hoping they bring it out on Blu-ray because it deserves a Blu-ray or 4K disc, basically, version of it, because it will be fantastic. Because I don't know how Peter Jackson gets the time to do all these sort of very meticulous things. I know he's got his new film at Modern Engines out at some point this month, which looks very good as well.
Mortal Engines, yeah. Mortal Engines, I think.
I always call it Modern Engines. It was Mortal Engines, and it's, you know, the book about the sort of big buildings that can move. I think that's sort of the preface of it, really.
Are you intrigued by our next time trailer for the episode called Kablam this weekend, written by Peter McTeague and directed by Jennifer Parra-Al? A few good guest stars are Lee Mack and Julie Hesman-Halk.
The trailer looks quite interesting. It's something like a mammoth warehouse sort of seeds thing. And they get sort of, the Doctor gets taken there because they reckon he's got mail or something like that, sort of some way of getting her. It did look interesting, you know, sort of maybe a more sort of tighter seeds. I know a lot of people want the Doctor to be on her own. I think a lot of people, I don't agree, I don't think you agree, I think a lot of people would like to see Jodie's Doctor in sort of in a real sort of peril situation on her own, basically.
Quite possibly we'll get that at some point. To me, it really does scream sort of McCoy season 25 and 24 and 25, a lot of which I don't like that much, you know, the sort of Paradise Towers-esque type thing, you know. I think in the trailer we have some sort of machine, sort of robot looking, what would you call them on a bus, conductor, saying, you know, the Doctor is required. So I think it's going to be that sort of stylized version, but, you know, done on the budget of today.
Well, yeah, because unlike you at the time, wasn't a big fan of Paradise Towers, but I think it actually stands at the time. So we will see. I know what you mean. Maybe sort of trying to, you know, do robots, you know, and sort of the whole feelings about people have these days about, you know, automation taking over in factories and all that sort of stuff. We will see. But, you know, if they're going for comedy, then they've got a good person, because Lee Mack can do really good comedy. I think his comedy Not Going Out, which they're repeating at the moment on BBC One, is one of the best comedies on TV at the moment. It's sort of very cleverly done. He can do good comedy. So I think if they're going for a comedy angle, then it will be quite good with him, I think.
Yeah, fantastic comedy show that. A great ensemble cast as well. Just to me, Al, I just think I'm looking forward more to the week after, the following week, which is the Witchfinders episode with Alan Cumming guesting as King James, I think.
Yeah, I think that will be really, really good. I think that's because it's like, you know, one episode before we get to the I don't know if it's going to be a two-part or not, 9 and 10, because it's the last two episodes of the season, so I don't know if that's going to be a two-part or not, but I think the Witchfinder and Gemma one, if it really goes into Witchfinding and Gemma and the whole way that even if you weren't a witch, you were still sort of burnt at the stake sort of thing, so I really want to see how dark they can go with that.
And at least one person on Gallifrey base, although we know very little even about the air date yet, there's been rumours of us having a New Year's Day special rather than the Christmas special, there may be a big named guest, apparently. Somebody has teased that it's somebody who's used to having a big show on Christmas Day, so people have speculated we might get to see Sir David Jason in Doctor Who at long last. That could be interesting.
Oh, that would be seriously good if we could get David Jason. What? Yeah, I don't know, because on one hand, I really enjoy it. It just feels like part of Christmas having Doctor Who on Christmas Day, and that's my outlook on that hand. But on the other hand, maybe, you know, because it's a brand new series and it's a whole new era, they want to give it that sort of, it's fresh, it's new, so we'll stick it in the maybe an hour episode again. We'll stick it in the Sherlock, you know, the sort of Sherlock New Year's Day slot, you know, because it's meant to be a main drama. But I just feel, you know, it's a bit comforting to have Doctor Who on Christmas Day, but that might just be me.
I know, I frequently don't really like the episodes that much. I think we've had about 13 Christmas specials now, and there's probably four that I look forward to rewatching again, which are I'll put Twice Upon a Time in there. It's not the absolute best, but I think The Snowman with Matt Smith is very good as well. The Christmas Invasion and The Voyage of the Damned are the ones I really like.
Yeah, that's the same with me. I would have said three, because I don't know with Twice Upon a Time. It is good, but I would definitely have the Snowman, the Voyage of the... I think Voyage of the Damned is definitely the best one after the Christmas Invasion. I don't know, because Voyage of the Damned is really good.
But people have been bringing up that Sherlock has a great presence, you know, sometimes on New Year's Day that gets good figures, so although it would be earlier in the day than Sherlock at 9 o'clock, you know, it's something to aim for, I suppose, if they really get the marketing ready for it.
Yeah, I suppose so. Well, I just think it should be on Christmas Day, so I expect they're probably going to stick the cute version of Watership Down in that spot on Christmas Day. That's probably the plan instead this year.
Mr. Capaldi's doing Watership Down, isn't he?
He is indeedy, but it's going to be apparently... I don't know if you've ever seen the original...
Yes.
You've seen the original great anime.
Traumatised since childhood. Still to this day.
If you're a child with the new one, you won't be, because apparently they've made it very less violent, apparently.
Oh, in a way that's sad, but in a way it's good.
It's good, because like me and you've both seen the original one with John Hurt, and it is extremely violent for an animation.
Anything you're looking forward to this week, Al? You wanted to see Fantastic Beasts when it's out.
I'm going to go and see it either at 1 minute past midnight if I can at the Picture House in Exeter, if it's got AD, well, they're not the most reliable. If not, I'm going to see it at 7 o'clock at the Odeon. So I'm definitely seeing it on day one, because I just want to. It just looks great. All the Twitter feeds from J.K. Rowling's been sort of ramping it up for like the last fortnight, and it just sounds brilliant. And you know, I haven't seen I don't think there has ever been a bad Harry Potter film, basically. Though it's not Harry Potter, there's some really good, apparently some very good sort of connections. You know, the whole fact that, you know, Nagini, Voldemort's snake, used to be a woman, and you're going to get to know her, basically, apparently.
Yes, and seeing Hogwarts again, of course, on the big screen.
Oh, it's just brilliant. In fact, you know, you've now got Jude Law as Dumbledore when he's younger. I think that was just a brilliant choice. I just don't think there's ever a J.K. Rowling film or TV things he does where, you know, because he's always completely involved, but isn't well worth a watch, basically.
Michael Gambon or Richard Harris as Dumbledore for you, Al? I'd say they're suitably really different. Tough. It's a bit like the Doctor. They're suitably differently played, aren't they?
It's really tough, because the first two films, I really enjoyed Richard Harris as Dumbledore, and I thought he got it just right, and of course he died, unfortunately, due to the Hellboy life he had, but I don't think... Gambon gets it a bit more closer to the book Dumbledore, I think.
Possibly. I think there's such great status and gravitas in those first two films, and I think Gambon soon gets into the rhythm, and I think I probably did prefer him by the end, but that's purely something out of luck with us getting more films out of him, you know, and he was super.
Yeah,
talking about Christmas specials for Doctor Who, that's one I do enjoy going back to now and again. I'll add another one, is A Christmas Carol with Gambon.
Oh, yeah, that is good. Actually, I forgot about that. Yeah, that is good, that one with, you know, because the music is stunning in that.
With Catherine Jenkins, yeah.
Yeah, Catherine Jenkins' track in that is stunning. I do actually own that on vinyl, and it sounds beautiful on vinyl, that album does. Yeah, it's just, I forgot about that one for a minute. Well, that is, Gambon is really good as that, in that one. I'm just interested to see how they're going to get Jude Law to play Dumbledore, because I think they are going to make him more gay than the other two, I think.
It was what J.K. Rowling had in mind for the character. Didn't think she ever actually put it in the book herself, but she did tweet it out a few years ago, didn't she, that he was going to be gay?
Yeah, there was never sort of mentioned. Well, it's slightly mentioned in the book with the sort of friendship he has with Nicholas Flamel, the person who invents the Philosopher's Stone. It's slightly there, but not in your face. You know, you have to sort of go back and look for it. So I don't know how Jude Law is going to play. Is he going to be more sort of, you know, sort of Cam Pearl? So I don't know. We'll see. I think Jude Law will be fantastic. It'll be very interesting to see how, you know, who gets the most screen time between him and Johnny Depp, never know, up against each other. It'll be very interesting to see how that plays out.
I mean, I do believe JK. I think she did wholeheartedly mean that for the character, but it was a good way of whipping up some of the right wing she's frequently in debate with on Twitter, shall we say.
He loves stirring up the right wing sort of idiot Twitters on Twitter. It's like I follow her on Twitter, and it's like you get like five to ten tweets a day from her, and they're just hilarious because she sort of knows that people will look at her tweets because of being J.K. Rowling, and they're just very sort of political sometimes about how she feels about things, and they're just fantastically funny.
Yeah, just stuff it up then, J.K., from both sides, you know, just do it.
Yeah, because she knows what people won't come back at her and say, oh, because you're J.K. Rowling, people won't come back at her, basically.
Exactly, but then you get that silly mentality nowadays. Oh, you're a famous rich person, your opinion doesn't count. Well, sorry it does, because they're human beings, and of course, you know, she came up from being a single motherhood, didn't she? So
yeah, she, you know, she worked.
Didn't have a lot of money.
She had no money and worked a bar for like the 15 years to get lots of millions now. Well, the idea is worth billions, I think, now. But, it, you know, she's worked all the time.
That opinion just comes from the whole mentality of wanting to silence people, doesn't it? You know, and we know how that goes in history, so.
Yeah, it's not good at all. Not good at all, those sort of opinions.
Anywho, no politics in Doctor Who next week. Kablam out.
No. Next week is a fun, sort of bouncy comedy episode, I reckon, with a bit of horror thrown in. That's my feeling from the trailer. I think you will not be, because that's what people will be moaning about this week, about how, oh god, it was so politically correct. We, you know, it was so boring. We turned off after 20 minutes, sort of feeling.
I'm just hoping it's fun. I want fun now, after the heaviness of last night.
We want some fun. I think we want some fun, and then we want a really dark, you know, not Jacobean, that's the word I'm looking for, Jacobean sort of history episode.
Next time, Doctor Who Target Files, we'll be discussing episode 7 of series 11, Kublam, written by Peter McTeague and directed by Jennifer Perrott. You can contact Doctor Who Target Files on Twitter at DW Target Files handle, search Facebook for our page and leave a message, or please do rate and review us on iTunes. Thank you so much for listening.